The Ross Owen Show is sponsored by DDayHistorian.com.
Hello, I'm Damian Lewis, and I played Major Dick Winters in Band of Brothers. You're listening to Ross Owen's interviews on Black Sky Radio.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to this very special show. It's the 23rd of December, only 2 days to Christmas. We're just back from Bastogne. We were over there with the Band of Brothers cast, honouring the veterans of World War II. And to visit some of those locations was just very humbling. I'm going to be speaking to Reg Jans, who was our tour guide over in Bastogne, and he's got some great stories to tell us. So stay tuned, I'm going to be speaking to Reg straight after this.
It was Christmas Eve, babe, in the drunk tank, and said to me, won't see another one. And then he sang a song, the rare old mountain tune. I turned my face away and dreamed about you. Got on a lucky one, came in 10 to 1. I've got a feeling this year's for me and you. So happy Christmas, I love you, baby. I can see a better time when all our dreams come true.
Queen of New York City.
When the band finished playing, they held out for more. Sinatra was swinging, all the drinks they were singing. We kissed on a corner, then danced through the night. The boys of the NYPD choir were singing, "Go away, babe." And the bells were ringing out for Christmas Day.
Dripping that boat.
You scumbag, you maggot, cheap, cheap, lousy faggot. Happy Christmas, you're ours, I pray God it's our love.
The boys of the NYPD choir still singing, "Go away, babe." And the bells are ringing out for Christmas Day.
Could have been someone.
Well, so could anyone. You took my dreams from me when I first found you.
I kept them with me, babe. I put them with my own. Can't make it all alone. I built my dreams around you.
The boys of the NYPD chorus to sing, and the bells are ringing out for Christmas Day.
Thank you.
Fairy Tale of New York by the Pogues and Kirsty McCall. And that was a special request from my next guest, who happens to be Reg Jans, a historian who's based in Belgium. And he looked after us last week when we were over there with the cast of Band of Brothers. So welcome to the show, Reg. Thank you for joining us on this very special Christmas show.
Hey, hello, Ross. Nice being here with you.
Have you recovered from our presence in Belgium? Because I know that it was you lost your voice over there. And so have you recovered fully from that?
Yeah. Fully recovered. Voice is back. Came back to me on Tuesday. You know. But I'm doing very well. And thank you for exhausting me so much.
Well, listen, we can't thank you enough for all the hard work that you put in before we got there, while we were there, and just everything you did, you know. And when we went to the Wajak, it was just incredible to hear the stories that you have. You've got so many. Now, I want to know how you got into this passion. I believe it was from listening to your grandfather's stories. Is that correct?
Well, basically, I had a broad interest in history in general. But my grandfather, being a World War II veteran, kind of triggered my interest in the Second World War. And, I remember being a kid when guys my age were watching movies such as Back to the Future. And so I was watching like The Longest Day, you know, A Bridge Too Far, The Guns of Navarone. So I can say that it was my grandfather's history that got me to the Second World War.
Now, do you live in the area? Are you born and bred in the Bastogne area? Is that where you're from?
Well, no, I live in the northern part of Belgium. That, you know, the war has been going on, occupation had been going on for 4 years. So my grandparents really endured it, the German occupation. So they can clearly remember, you know, the rationings, you know, how they were unable to go out after dark and stuff like that. So there's stories that I kind of grew up with.
Mm-hmm. And what prompted you to become a tour guide?
I just ran into it. It just happened to me because ever since I was a kid, I had this fair interest in history, World War II history. Mm-hmm. And ever since I got a driver's license, I made my single trips to the Ardennes, because that's what I've been reading about, the Battle of the Bulge. Now, being there, I had the honor to meet a few veterans that were visiting their former battlefields, and I got to talk to them, and we exchanged addresses, and, you know, I wrote them a letter. I got a letter back like 8 weeks later, because there was no internet. And, you know, with their letters, with their stories, with the books that I had, I went back to find these places, retrace their steps, like trying to find the small pieces of the puzzle it all together. You know, and then later on, it was the internet, so the whole world opened to me. So a lot more information came my way, which was great for all the extra research. But also people, you know, found a way to get to me. So I started getting these requests like, hey, you know, they recommended you, and it seemed that you know some stuff from that area. And so I started to take people down there. But after a while, I was taking people down there like nearly every weekend. So that's what kind of it just all happened to me.
Now, when I was in Belgium and spoke to some of the cast members about why it's important that the next generation know about what happened in World War II, and I'll ask you the same question: why do you think it's important that we pass on this message of what these men did?
Well, I think it's really, really important for the future generations to know what these men did for us. Now, I have not experienced it yet, losing my freedom, that my grandparents had, you know, and I learned about this. And losing your freedom is not good. And at the political today situation in the world, everywhere people are losing their freedoms. And I think it's really important to know that it's, once you lose your freedom, it's very, very hard to get it back. But for us, it turned out well, because of these soldiers, these British, American, Belgian, French soldiers who fought and gave everything and died for our freedom to give it back. And we should appreciate it. Now, most of these veterans are not among us anymore. Now, the line is getting shorter, and I think it's really important for the future generations to remember them, that they were the ones who gave back our freedom. Mm-hmm. And because today, now they take everything for granted, but they should realize that somebody paid a high price for what we have now. I mean, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, anything.
Yeah, we take it for granted. Now, you've got lots of stories to tell. You were telling me earlier that you have a few stories with a sort of Christmas theme that you would like to share with us, which I think our listeners would love to hear.
Well, there's just a few things that I remember. These are some stories, personal accounts of the veterans that share these stories with me on one of my tours. And because, you know, hey, it's almost Christmas, you know, we should celebrate, we should think on about everything about the ones we love and the ones we have to get along with. I clearly remember the story of John Primorano. And John was a guy who served with the 501st Parachute Infantry Regiment in the 101st Airborne Division. And he was at regimental headquarters in the wire section. So basically, his job was, you know, laying the communication lines from the command posts all the way up to the front lines. And when these lines were damaged, you know, because of enemy shelling, he had to run out in the field and fix it. Now, in between, he spent most of his time at his field switchboard or at his main switchboard at the seminary school in Bastogne, which was the regimental headquarters of the 501st Regiment. Now, after General McAuliffe, you know, the acting commander of the division, had replied nuts to the German ultimatum to surrender on the 22nd of December 44. The Germans started bombing the town of Bastogne for 3 days in a row, which is pretty heavy, combination of air force and artillery fire. Now, the day before Christmas, one of John's best friends died in his arms, you know, just outside of the center of Bastogne. Now, a shell came in when they were laying the wires, and they were both blown, you know, off their feet. John was, you know, blown against the wall, but his buddy landed across the street, and he ran up there, and the guy died in his arms. That was one of his best friends. Now, the following day, on Christmas, John was operating his main switchboard at the headquarters, and he was thinking of his friend, and there was a lot of stuff going through his mind, and he realized, you know, he wasn't feeling well. He was sweating. His hands were trembling and shaking. And he said that he really had it with the war. They call it battle fatigue. Mm. So he left the switchboard and he walked out of the building of the command post, and all hell broke loose, you know, shells exploding everywhere. But he crossed the intersection and walked straight up to the main church of Bastogne, the St. Peter's Church. And when he got there, he opened the big wooden door and he stepped inside. And when he closed the door behind him, he said, it was like walking into a vacuum tunnel. It was so quiet there. Nothing was good. It was just silence in there. And I was the only one in there. And he said, I took my helmet off, still sweating, still shaking. And I sat down on the chair and I started looking around and I noticed there were a few holes in the roof of the church from debris that came down through it. And while I was sitting there, he said, all of a sudden, I looked through the holes and the sky cleared. And a beam of light came shining in through one of these holes. And it shone right onto a big wooden crucifix that was blown off the church's wall that was just lying there on the ground. And that beam landed right on that crucifix. And he said, I saw that, and all of a sudden, I felt like being embraced by two arms.
Wow.
And however, he said, I was all alone in that church. I could clearly hear a voice whisper to me, you'll be fine. And John said, my hand stopped shaking. I stopped sweating. I felt the energy return to my body from the tip of my toes to the tip of my nose. He said, I picked up my helmet again. I stood up, I walked to the door, opened it, and hell broke loose again. But that did not bother me anymore because I knew I was going to make it.
Wow.
And I asked Joan, like, okay, what happened next? And he says, hey, listen, I'm still here. And every time, now Joan has been back for 30 years, at least 30 times since the war. And every time when he comes back to Europe, he makes this one trip to Bestown to go to the church.
That's incredible.
It's an incredible story. And about 3 years ago, that was one of Joan's last trips back. Because we've been in that church many times with him, and where he always tells the story the exact same way. And he gets really emotional when he tells the story, because it had such an impact on his life. And but we never thought of, like, hey, maybe the cross is still there. So we started looking around, and we couldn't find anything alike. You know, it was too small, or it was not wooden, or until we saw this one single door, which is right behind the organ. So when you go into the main church of Bestown, there's a huge organ. It's a door next to it that brings you to the back of the organ. And we walked in there. I switched on the light and looked up the wall, and there it was. Still the exact same wooden cross, and everything went silent again. John was silent. But you could see on his face that it was a relief to see that crucifix again.
Amazing.
And now he's able to talk about it, you know. He found closure, but that was so a special moment for him during his time in Bestown during the Battle of the Bulge. It was Christmas Day, 1944.
Makes the hairs on my neck stand up. That's just incredible.
It's a real personal story.
Yes. And you get the privilege to hear all these stories from the vets. Can you share any other stories with us?
Well, there's this one, and this is maybe one that grabbed me the most. And this kind of was brought up by the veteran himself after we did a tour with his family in Bestown. Now, his name was Frank Sisson, and Frank was one of the guys, as being like a teenager, he kind of joined the Navy, but then later, you know, changed to Army. And the reason was, he said, that he figured out that he could walk much farther than he could swim, you know. And he served with the 667th Field Artillery Battalion, you know, an artillery guy, and his unit was attached to General Patton's 3rd Armor. Third Army, I mean. Mm-hmm. Now, he being in the Ardennes campaign, he remembered that very, very well. So we did a small tour of that area. And he said, at the end of the day, he said, well, let me share a story with the whole group here. And then he said, well, listen, after the Ardennes, the Battle of the Bulge, and the Rhineland campaign, I was promoted from corporal to line sergeant, and I was moved to Berlin in 1945, you know, that's where I worked as a military police investigator in downtown Berlin. And he said, that's where I had my best Christmas ever. He said it was cold and gloomy. It was freezing. There was like 12, 13 inches of snow in the streets of Berlin. You know, the people were wandering around the city. The children were cold. You know, their bellies were swollen. They were hungry. You know, there was not enough food. But we, at our GI kitchen, at our headquarters, she said, were getting ready for our Christmas dinner. And the cooks had made such a wonderful meal, and it smelled so good. And all, you know, the table was laden with the best food we could find and we could cook. And we were all getting ready to eat. When I looked at the window and I noticed that several children, young ones, were now looking in through the window into our kitchen, into our room. And they were starving. And they were drafted by the aromas, you know, the smell that came out of the building. He said, that really ruined my appetite. So I pushed my plate aside. I stood up and I walked into the kitchen. I asked the cooks if they had any more hamburgers left. And I asked them to cook them for me and let me know when they were ready. Shortly thereafter, Frank got a call from the kitchen. He picked up two big bags with cooked hamburgers. And he took him outside, and he pushed the snow from the curb, and he sat down, and he called the children to sit down with him. And he said, listen, I got burgers for you guys. You can't take them home, but I'll share one with you here. You each can have one, but we will eat it here together. And that's when Frank started to hand out his hamburgers to the hungry children in Berlin. And all together they ate them. And Frank said, all I could see were smiling faces. And that was the best Christmas I ever had. The guys from my unit walked by. Even my captain came by. He stopped and he saluted me.
Wow.
And that's not the end of the story, because the most amazing part is yet to come. Because then Frank said, well, in 1998, the Daily Oklahoma, which is a local newspaper, because Frank's he lives in Oklahoma City.
Mm-hmm.
He said they did a contest and they selected my story out of dozens of other submissions. And I had sent him the story of the hamburgers in Berlin. So what did they do? They published my Berlin story on the front page of the newspaper. That same afternoon, he said, I received a phone call at home, and there was a voice on the other side of the line, you know, with a very heavy European accent, asking me, like, I'm sorry, sir, but are you Mr. Sisson, whose story that was published in the paper this morning? And Frank says, yeah, we're a little bit surprised, like, yes, why, may I ask? And the guy said, well, listen, I'm from Berlin. I was born and raised there. But I'm here in the United States to visit some friends for the holidays. And this morning at the breakfast table, we all had a good cry when we read your article and your story. Because now I'm calling you to say thank you, because that story that we read is the story that I have heard every year around Christmas, ever since I was a boy. Because one of these kids on the curb there with you was my dad.
Oh, man.
And so I want to say thank you for that. And Frank was so speechless, he said, well, okay, thank you too. And they both hung up. And Frank, of course, regretted it, because he wanted to ask if his father was still alive, mm-hmm. and what happened to him. But, you know, they were so speechless,
yeah.
and that they just hung up the phone.
That's just an incredible story, isn't it? And again, here's my neck standing up from these. It's just so many different stories that you don't expect to hear, you know. And I would encourage anyone who is planning to go to Belgium or to go and see some of the locations in Bastogne to look up Reg and to listen to it, because you've got so many other stories as well on the battlefield. Now tell us where people can find out more about you, because you have more than one website.
Well, I actually I got my own site for my tours that I guide and that I do. It's called regjans.com.
Regjans.com.
My name in one word, .com, where you can find more detailed and specific information about the tours that I offer and the possible sites, customized tours, standard tours.
Let me just spell that out for those listening. That's regjans.com. Regjans.com. I say regjans, but it's a silent J.
Yeah.
Okay, and about the other websites that you have going?
Well, the one I'm working on now is worldwarmedia.com, but mm-hmm. it's not live yet, so I hope to get it online somewhere February 2017. And this is sort of a website. Well, what we're trying to do is we're going to try to break history closer to the people, and people closer to history, mainly focusing on personal accounts and more detailed stories about the veterans and veterans from all different conflicts.
Mm-hmm.
So just to keep their stories documented, but just keeping it documented is not enough, because I think they need to be shared, you know, because that's, you know, you can talk about tactics, you can talk about armor, you can talk about weapons, but you know, it's the personal accounts that brings it all to life, you know.
Yeah.
To to really understand what these guys went through. And and that's what I often hear from the families as well. Like when they hear the stories from their dad, like, hey, he never told us that. Now we understand, you know, why he has been such a dad to us, why we couldn't ask him this, why we were not allowed to do that, why we had to finish our plate, you know, because what he'd been through. And we would have never known that without these stories. So it's very, very important. And with that new website, World War Media, I'm hoping that I can share more of these kind of stories to the public, but not just me. So anyone who has good stories from, you know, their time in the service, or from their family members, personal accounts from their tours in Vietnam, Afghanistan, Second World War, Civil War, anything. I'm offering a platform for people who wants to publish their stories or videos, articles, anything, photos as well.
Now, you also have a Facebook page where people can reach out to you there as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, the Facebook page that people can follow me on is just under my name, Red Jans, or Battlefield Experience.
Battlefield Experience.
Battlefield Experience. That's the name I operate my tours on.
Sure. Now, for you personally, you do these tours for people of all ages. There's no restrictions on ages or anything like that.
I prefer that people should be at least like 12 years old.
Well, yes, of course.
It depends, because you know, I once had a pretty rough time with an 8-year-old kid who kept asking me all these details about tanks. And if there's anything, you know, I can tell you stuff about tanks. I can tell you great stuff about tanks. But that kid was amazing, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I had to ask his dad to leave him in the car because he was embarrassing me. No, that was a joke.
Listen, what is it? What's the best part of doing this job for you? What is the best part, the most satisfying part of it?
Well, the most satisfying part is that it's the personal side of it. It's for the people, you know, to give people the answers they're looking for, sometimes about their family members, to find out what really happened, or just give people, help people to find closure.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I take people back to the places where, for example, their father was killed, you know, and the first time they stand on that ground where he actually died, you know, that's really, it often gets really emotional.
Yeah. But you know? we saw that, for instance, with Scotty Gordon last weekend, whose father's foxhole is Smokey Gordon is there.
Yeah, it's amazing, huh? It's you know, because we were quite, by doing all the in-depth research, we were like 90% sure that that would be the one that he was dug in with his assistant machine gunner Frank Mallet. And but then being there with Scotty and actually standing in that hole with Scotty Gordon and Ben Kaplan, who portrayed Smokey in the miniseries, was amazing. But then, you know, Scotty confirmed that. He said, well, you know, well, Dad walked in here on his way, when he, on this return trip, and he pointed straight to this one and said, that's the one. This was my hole because I had a T shape. Now, so he just filled in the missing 10%. That were of confirmation that we were still looking for, and that was really amazing. Also for Scotty being there, you know, knowing that his father was shot in that foxhole, and also for the veterans, that's also very rewarding. Is bringing some veterans back to these grounds. Sometimes they don't want to make these trips back to Europe because they are afraid to get too emotional. Once they get there, they do get emotional. And but then very often after the trip, they they seem to have changed as a person. I have family members contacting me like, thank you so much what you did for my father, because it was really moving. He was crying, he was always crashing there, you know, on that location. But you know, since we got back, the nightmares have gone. You know, and maybe this because he found closure.
I was just going to say that they find some sort of closure by going back there. Also, you were there when Bill Garnier and Babe visited. Is that correct?
Oh yeah, Babe. I had him on my tours about like 10 years ago.
I've seen the photographs of that, but you told a great story about Bill and the little boy. in the woods. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, well, basically, that was a story that that I picked up somewhere from the Entourage when I was touring with them. But it actually happened years before I got to meet them and got to tour with them. But you know, Bill lost his leg on the 3rd of January in the Bojack. And you know, when he made his trips back to Bastogne, I never saw him with a using a wheelchair. He was only using his crutches. And in one of his first trips back, he was like taking the group to the location where he thought that he was wounded, and they were talking there. And meanwhile, like a local guy with his like 8 or 9 year old son was walking, you know, on one of the logging roads crossing the woods, and he noticed like a bunch of people down there, and one, of course, one of them was wearing a hat saying like World War II veteran. So he kind of like sneaked up to the group to listen to what they were saying. And it turned out to be, you know, the party of Bill Garnier and Babe Heffron. But his boy, you know, he was intrigued by seeing Bill's missing leg there, and he kept staring at it and couldn't keep his eyes off it. Then all of a sudden, Garnier, he turns around and he goes like, "What are you looking at?" And you know, a bit surprised by it, you know, the boy points at Bill's legs. And so Garnier goes like, "Well, you know what, son? You know, I lost my leg here like 50-some years ago. I'll give you $5 if you find it."
That's fantastic. And didn't he give him the $5 anyway?
Well, that's how the story goes in different versions. But apparently that boy kept sneaking around the woods looking to find a leg. Of course, he couldn't. But then some people told me that Bill and actually... felt sorry for the boy and just gave him his five bucks. So
yeah, that sounds like the sort of a thing Bill would do. He was such a character, Bill Garnier.
Yeah, he was. Yeah. So was Babe.
And you know, Babe as well. Yeah.
Babe would be. I remember being with some friends on the tour that we did with them together in Bastogne. That they were sitting outside in the evening, outside on the terrace. It was a nice day in September in the evening, and you know, they always based out from their favorite cafe, which is the Nuts Cafe in Bastogne, and we were sitting outside. We were just having a few drinks, and I noticed there was this lady, and she seemed to be pretty nervous, and she was walking by our terrace about like 10, 15 times, you know. So I figured like, hey, I think she's looking to meet these guys here, you know. So I decided to just walk up to her, and I asked her. I said, "Listen, are you looking for these guys?" And she said, "Oh yeah, I'm a big fan of them." And so I just say, "Hey, why don't you come and you know, and meet the guys?" So I invited her to the veterans table, and she really appreciated that, and she had a good time talking to these two guys. And after a while, she got up and said, "Sorry, I gotta go, but would you mind doing me a favor?" And of course, these veterans, yeah, they couldn't resist. It was like a nice blonde lady. So they said, "Yeah, sure. What can we do for you?" And she said, "Would you please mind signing something for me?" So these guys go like, "No, of course not. Bring it on." And so she opened her purse and she pulls out a white bra. And these guys were looking at each other and they were like, "Is she serious?" So anyway, they asked for a marker, and Bill grabbed the bra, put it on a table, and he started writing on one of the boobs like, "Wild Bill Garnier, and like, Easy Company, Band of Brothers, Philadelphia." So then he passed the bra on to Babe, who was clearly amused by everything that had been going on at that moment. And Babe took the marker and he just wrote on the other boob, "Wish I was here, Babe."
Fantastic. What a couple of guys. When we had them on the show, when we did the tribute to Major Winters, who had just passed away at the time, and we had them on separately, actually. We had Bill on first and Babe on second. And it was snowing in Philadelphia at the time. And I remember Nightmare, the co-host, had said to them, you know, "What? Just keep yourselves warm, you know, with that storm, the cold weather, the snow." And they're like, "Hey, man, it's nothing compared to Bastogne. And there's nobody shooting at us now." He said, "It's a cakewalk, pal." And both of them separately in their interviews said the same thing. And so, yeah, what those guys went through in Bastogne is just, I mean, you can explain it better than me, but They had no supplies, little food, little clothing, and they had to hold that line.
The situation was terrible all over the Ardennes. You know, it was such a large battlefield, and we covered 1,450 square miles of battlefield here. Mm-hmm. So that's big. Yeah, that's really big. And Bastogne was just a small piece of that giant cake. You know, the difference was that at Bastogne, a total of 18,000 Americans got completely cut off, surrounded by the German forces, which means an entire division, 101st Airborne Division, who got into Bastogne on foot, except parachuting into it. They arrived by trucks and made their tailgate jump and then walked into Bastogne, barely equipped because they were rushed out of Camp Mermelon in France. You know, they were told to grab a rifle, find some ammunition, no time to pick up your coats or anything, and they were just moved out. They arrived there, barely equipped. Paul Jackson was one of the guys who told me when he walked into Bastogne, he had just like 20 rounds of ammo, his M1 Garand and two hand grenades. That was it. You know, not enough food. And then a lot of the units that had been fighting for Bastogne were now fighting for time and, you know, fighting their way back to Bastogne. So the Germans moved around on both sides. And on the 21st of December, they completely surrounded 18,000 American soldiers who were running out of ammunition, didn't have proper winter clothing, had no decent food. Luckily for them, the snow had not come in yet. You know, it had been snowing in other regions in the Ardennes, but there was no snow in Bastogne when these guys got there to the front line. Now, the heavy snow came in on the 24th of December. Now, it started a little bit of snow in the evening of the 23rd, but then on the 24th, the heavy snow started to come in. And that's when the situation got critical, because now the temperatures was going down. So for 5 days until the day after Christmas, the 26th of December, that's when General Patton's 4th Armored Division, you know, broke the German encirclement and relieved the pressure on these guys. You know, and that's when a supply line was established and trucks were driven in to resupply the troops. Also, supply missions were flown by C-47s. To drop supplies into the whole of the Donut. But for 5 days, they were completely cut off, you know, from supplies, from ammunition, from everything, and they had to hold the line at all costs.
And even those supplies, they would get little things like two toothbrushes and...
Yeah, well basically, the most of the supply drops that were dropped by air was artillery ammunition, because that was needed the most to keep the Germans away from the city, from the center of the city.
Yeah.
But, you know, they were cut off. You know, they couldn't wash themselves. The snow was there was no snow yet, but on the 24th, there was snow. They had to melt it, to drink, to brush their teeth with the twigs from a tree. One guy told me that after the first supply drops, that they finally got some toothbrushes, and there were two for each platoon.
Yeah.
At time, so that's, let's say at that time a platoon was still around 40 guys, so you better be the first one in line then.
Yeah, as you said, it's like sharing your underwear. Having to share a toothbrush.
It was the same. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but these conditions were terrible. But then when the pressure was relieved and the supplies came in, but that's when the temperature when started going down. You know, into minus during daytime also, and the coldest period during the Battle of the Bulge was the second and the third week of January, with the lowest temperature measured officially by the weather stations was minus 22 Celsius, which equals minus 7 Fahrenheit. But still, you know, when you hear these veterans speak, they mention temperatures much lower than that. And are they lying? Well, no, they're not lying, but most of the time, these guys were dug in on what they call the military crest, which is like another high ground exposed to the wind chill. And it's that wind chill that brings your body temperature down at a high pace, you know, especially when your clothes are wet.
Right.
Yeah, and that increases the risk of frostbite exponentially.
Yeah.
So a lot of these guys were evacuated, not because they were shot, but because of frostbite, gangrene, trench foot. Yeah. Anything like that.
And of course, some of them actually did freeze to death.
Yep.
You know, yeah. And one of the veterans was telling a story of how they would sometimes use frozen bodies of the enemy as protection.
Yeah, it happened on some occasions that a few guys, you know, to get some more protection from incoming rounds, because, you know, most of the guys dug in the surrounding areas of Bastogne, mostly using the woods as cover. Yeah, but of course the Germans there were firing 88 guns directly at the woods and lobbing artillery rounds, 75 rounds, coming in, lobbing them into these woods, and with a blast going down as they exploded up in the trees, or using the shells with a time mechanism, so when they explode up in the air. That was more effective to them, because then the blast goes V-shaped down. You can cause a lot more damage. When it explodes on impact on the ground, the blast goes up, so there's less damage that way.
Yeah. Wow. Well, listen, Reg, I can't thank you enough for taking out the time to come on the show today, because...
Hey, it's been a pleasure, Roz. It was great talking to you, you know. You know, as I told you back in Bestown, we can go on like that for hours and hours and hours.
Well, we'll definitely get you back on again, and we're going to do a special recap on the Bastogne visit. We'll get some of the actors on to recap after the Christmas holidays, and we must get you back on as well. And I'm going to get Dale Dye back on as well, back on the show. So we must get you part of that show. But in the meantime, guys, if you want to find out more about what Reg does, visit his website, regjans.com. Go there and you will see lots of videos. You will get lots of information, photographs, and everything you need to know about what he does, what Reg does. And if you get the chance to go over there, please look Reg up. It's definitely worth going with someone who knows what they're talking about, and he'll take you to places that and tell you stories that you just won't believe. Absolutely incredible. Reg, thanks very much again for coming on the show. Have a great Christmas, a great new year, and we'll speak to you in 2017.
Okay, it was a pleasure, Ross. Happy holidays to you, and see you next year, mate.
See you next year, buddy. Thanks again, Reg. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hi, I'm Paul Woodatch, D-Day historian, a battlefield tour guide in Normandy, France. I offer tours of the D-Day landing beaches of 1944, along with my partner Magali. If you would like to find out more, see my website at www.ddayhistorian.com and my partner Magali's at www.ddayforyou.com.